Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. Meet Wise, one account for over 50 currencies, because today your life is bigger than one currency. Whether you're sending pesos to your parents, receiving dollars from a friend, or spending in euros, you can do it all in one account. With Wise, you can manage your money across borders cheaper, faster, and easier. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving, and try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Europe withers, record-breaking heat across much of the continent. In Spain, wildfires have forced thousands from their homes.
Es que era una bola de fuego. En 15-20 minutos se veía toda la
This
montaña.
Man says a hillside turned into a ball of fire, consuming everything in 15 or 20 minutes. It's not just Spain.
One way to think about climate change is think of it as loading the dice.
Ensuring that extreme weather events will become more frequent and severe across the globe. Also today, the rise of evangelical Christians as a political force in Brazil. One firebrand televangelist is leading the way for Pentecostals there.
Nós é que apoiamos e temos que...
We have to make our citizenship count, says the pastor, and to vote for the people who support us. I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for starting the week with us. It's a hot one today in many parts of the country, temps approaching 100 degrees across much of the Northeast, which, compared to Texas and the Plain States, counts as cool. Across the pond in Europe, record-breaking heat waves are creating unprecedented havoc and costing lives. More than 1,000 deaths in Spain and Portugal are being attributed to the heat. Even usually temperate Britain is feeling it. The UK could top out at 104 degrees Fahrenheit in the next 24 hours. That would be the hottest temperature ever recorded in the UK. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins me now from Madrid, where the mercury is hovering around triple digits. So the worst hit region in terms of lives lost from the heat so far in southern Europe, Orla, I understand, is Portugal. What do we know at this point about the impact of the heat wave there?
Yeah, that's right, Marco. Parts of Portugal recorded temperatures of around 47 degrees, which is over 116 Fahrenheit over the last few days. On one day, in fact, alone last week, around 170 fires broke out in just a 24-hour period. So they've had a state of emergency in place for the last number of days up until yesterday evening. And they reckon a few hundred people have been injured by the fires. But the Portuguese Health Ministry is saying today it estimates that around 650 people have died from heat-related causes. So most of these deaths have been caused by the effect of the heat wave on individuals as opposed to the forest fires themselves. The Portuguese authorities are saying they are still fighting several fires in Portugal today, but the majority have been brought under control and the temperatures are expected to drop over the next few days. So things are expected to calm down.
Right. So Portugal cooling down a bit. But in France right now, seems to be the opposite, where conditions are getting worse. The number of evacuations has been going up over the last couple of days. What more can you tell us about the situation, especially in southwest France?
The problem is, and particularly in the southwest region, it's not just the high temperatures, but also the high winds. So today they're battling two really gigantic blazes in southwest France in the Gironde region, which is sort of a coastal area near Bordeaux. And the fire chief was saying this afternoon, they've never had to deal with two blazes of this size at the same time. Thousands of residents have been forced to leave their homes. And also because it's a really popular tourist region, thousands of tourists have also been evacuated. Many of them would just have been staying in campsites. They've had to move. And by the way, the Tour de France, Marco, is also underway at the moment, which is grueling enough at the best of times. They've had to pour tens of thousands of litres of cold water onto the roads that the cyclists are racing on to try and cool down the tarmac, as the tarmac itself is in danger of melting.
So while all this is going on, how much discussion is there in Europe right now about the ways this extreme weather is connected to climate change?
Yeah, climate activists are certainly saying to politicians, how many more warning signs do we have to give you? But still, in Spain, I heard earlier today, the far-right Vox party dismissed any connection between these blistering hot temperatures and climate change. But I put the question to an expert earlier, a climate scientist at the University of Edinburgh, Simon Tett, and I asked him if he thinks this is what climate change looks like.
One way to think about climate change is think of it as loading the dice. So if you think that 40-degree events were probably once in a century or less events, And now they're becoming maybe once in a decade events. So that's climate change is increasing dramatically the risk of high temperature extremes. This is what climate change means, I think.
And the climatologist, he's in the UK, which is on red alert today for the very first time. How are people in the UK dealing with this level of heat?
Not very well. The problem with the UK is it's just not built for this kind of heat. Many rail services today were reporting there would be speed restrictions because there's fears that the tracks will buckle in the heat and derail the trains. And just a short time ago, flights from London's Luton Airport have all now been suspended because the runway at Luton has been closed because there's problems caused by the heat there. Hospitals, Marco, they've been cancelling surgeries this afternoon because they said the operating theatres were simply too hot for surgeons to operate, for them to safely operate in. And then it's expected to get hotter tomorrow. So by all accounts, and according to climate scientists like Simon Tett, Brits will need to get used to it because this is the new normal.
A very troubling reality. Orla Barry is the world's Europe correspondent joining us from the heat of Madrid. Orla, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Reporter Jerry Haddon is in northeastern Spain, where he's been following the largest wildfire so far this year. More than 4,000 acres burned last night in an area outside of Barcelona. Hundreds of people were evacuated from their homes. Jerry had eyes on one part of that blaze. He witnessed it around the village of San Fritos de Bages.
I was driving back from the Pyrenees with my family, and suddenly we found ourselves passing through really thick smoke. An hour later, we were forced off the highway, and we had to drive around the fire itself. In the dark, you could appreciate its ferocity. There was just this huge, rolling orange line of light coming down the mountains. I went back to the village this morning and ran into a guy named Francisco Hernandez walking his golden retriever in a field right near that highway, right in front of a charred hillside forest.
A las cuatro y pico cuando bajé justamente aquí ya estaba toda esta lateral de la montaña.
I came down around 4:30 in the afternoon, and that entire hillside was a ball of fire. In 15 or 20 minutes, the fire consumed everything, spreading across the farmlands. Four or five helicopters were dumping water, but it didn't have any effect. We thought that ball of fire might cross this field, but luckily some farmers came and plowed in front of our street. Otherwise, that fire could have reached my home within 10 minutes.
Hernandez got lucky. About 1,000 other nearby residents were forced to flee. Many slept in this local civic center on Red Cross cots. This morning, people were just milling about, waiting to find out if it was safe to go back home, like this man sitting nervously with his dog, Boss.
Hola, me llamo Tony. Y estamos desalojados de una urbanización de Las Brocardas.
Hi, my name is Tony. We've been evacuated from a housing development called Las Brocardas. It's been a day, and we don't know whether our houses have been damaged. They told us to come to this center to get help and food, even for our dogs, and for those who didn't have another place to sleep, to pass the night. Last night, we stayed home till the last minute, trying to wet the trees down with the garden hose. It was absurd, really. When it became hard to breathe and we saw that all the neighbors' cars were gone, we decided we had to leave too.
I meet two sisters, they're twins actually, killing time over a Coca-Cola. They're waiting for news, too, about their family home.
Well, my name is Mireia, and we are in San Fritos del Bages. Yeah, I have talked with firemen, and they said that today the weather is very hot, and it's not sure to... It's dangerous to go to the house. It's very sad because we have a lot of memories. With the swimming pool, all the trees that we have planted, every single space you see, you remember your childhood.
Roser Vilat, and yes, we are really sad because of the reasons that my sister has explained. People from Brocardas is like a family. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody has gone to the neighbor house, yes, to have a dinner, to have lunch. So it's like a crisis in a family. It's not the houses.
Nor the things in the houses, except maybe when your health depends on it. Two elderly women sitting inside the Civic Center cafeteria are hoping the police can escort them home, just for a moment. My friend needs her rheumatoid arthritis medication, says one, and I need my depression pills. We haven't taken our meds for a full day, she tells me. The women end up getting the police escort home, but this heat wave and this fire are not close to being over. There's no telling when these evacuees might be allowed to go back home for good. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, San Fritos de Bages, Spain.
Damages from storms, droughts, and flooding made worse by climate change, all that carries a massive cost, like in the trillions of dollars. Who should pay has been a long-running debate. At the UN, poorer countries have been asking for financial help from richer countries, nations that have historically emitted the most greenhouse gases that fuel climate change. As The World's Carolyn Beeler reports, the deliberations are intensifying.
Hurricane Irma hit Antigua and Barbuda in 2017, devastating the country and damaging a substantial part of its road network. During rebuilding, the country wanted to repair those roads so they could withstand bigger floods.
So taking it from normal roads, business as usual roads, to climate resilient roads.
But Antiguan official Mackay Robertson says the country couldn't get funding quickly enough from development banks or existing climate funds.
No one was really there, and it's not for lack of trying.
Developing countries want a pot of money dedicated specifically to things like this: building back better quickly after disasters, addressing slower onset climate events like drought, and figuring out how to compensate communities who can't build back, like when their towns are flooded by rising seas.
For example, to create a museum to memorialize a specific community or to publish a book that sort of captures the culture and the heritage that is permanently lost. But they need funding.
The U.S. and European countries have long resisted creating a fund specifically for losses and damages, as they're called at the U.N., in part due to fears of admitting liability. It's at the top of the priority list for developing countries at the next UN climate summit in November. Mackay Robertson will be negotiating for the Alliance of Small Island States at the summit.
That is essentially the big ask that we have. This promise, this commitment that we are going to establish this facility.
A facility or loss and damage fund. At a meeting last month, an item on this was blocked from being put on the agenda at this November's climate summit, and activists reacted with a protest.
Loss and damage
on the agenda!
Loss and damage
on the agenda!
Today and tomorrow, environment ministers from around the world are meeting again in Germany for more climate talks. In a video message, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told them the issue has, quote, languished on the sidelines for too long.
It is eroding the trust we need to tackle the climate emergency together. Loss and damage is happening now. We need a concrete global response that addresses the needs of the world's most vulnerable people, communities, and nations.
The issue is becoming increasingly urgent as droughts, floods, and more potent storms devastate communities. And some leaders from developed countries are starting to publicly acknowledge the funding gap, says Carolina Cecilio from the climate change think tank E3G.
The whole loss and damage topic, it has been talked about for over 20 years right now. But I feel like since COP26, I think the whole discussion around the financing really is building a momentum.
Cecilio says if real progress isn't made at the upcoming UN climate summit, COP27, this issue risks derailing many others.
If nothing gets done, countries might be using it to block progress on negotiations, because this is very frustrating for them right now.
A group of 55 countries particularly vulnerable to climate change announced in April that they were creating their own fund for climate damages as a kind of proof of concept. Emmanuel Tichy-Obain is a Ghanaian environmental official and leader of the group.
In most of the vulnerable countries, our bridges have been taken away by floods. Our farms have been taken away by droughts. Our schools have been taken away by storms. So the purpose of it is to make sure that the developed countries or the bigger emitters who are responsible for these losses take care for it.
Last fall, Scotland pledged $2.7 million to a loss and damage fund, hoping to spur other developed countries to contribute. So far, according to the Scottish government, only the region of Wallonia in Belgium has joined them. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Sri Lanka is in crisis. People are rationing food and fuel and dealing with power blackouts. The country's president resigned last week after protesters stormed his palace. Through all this turmoil, the bowlers ain't waiting for the politics to get sorted out. The sport of cricket continues to be played. As we hear from reporter Sushmita Pathak, cricket matches and uprisings happening alongside each other has made for quite a spectacle.
Usually, when Australia's cricket team plays in Sri Lanka, they are the enemy. But in late June, after winning a match in the Sri Lankan capital Colombo, Australian cricketers got a surprising response from spectators. Sri Lankan fans cheering for them, wearing the Australian yellow jersey instead of their own blue. The whole stadium was full of Australian flags and big posters that read, "Thank you, Australia." Cricket blogger Indusan Shantakumaran says Sri Lankans are grateful to Australia for coming to play in their country during one of the toughest times in its history.
Because Sri Lanka was like going through a turmoil and Australia agreed to travel here. So it was like a very, very emotional moment for all of us.
When the Australian men's cricket team arrived in Sri Lanka in early June for a six-week tournament, there was a lot of anxiety. Clashes had been breaking out during anti-government protests. There were also ethical concerns. But Sri Lanka saw Australia's decision to come as a show of solidarity. Here's Mohan De Silva, a top official of Sri Lanka's Cricket Association, at a press conference.
When some of the other major countries in the world who have imposed travel advisories, Australia to visit Sri Lanka is a huge endorsement of the fact that Sri Lanka is a safe place. This tour will also have very important economic benefits to the country.
Officials said that revenue from ticket sales for all games will be donated to public welfare. The matches are also bringing some desperately needed foreign currency into Sri Lanka from the sale of television broadcast rights. But more than anything, the matches are a welcome distraction. When cricket fan Arvindan Arunthawanthan went to see the first Australia match in early June, he says the atmosphere was electrifying.
You know, the vibe was different. There was a lot of anticipation and expectation, and there was an air of hope. And it was surreal, to be honest. And we wanted to be there just to feel that, irrespective of the outcome of the game.
That match didn't go Sri Lanka's way. But a few weeks later, Sri Lanka won a crucial match at the very last moment.
High into the air. This will be taken and is. And Sri Lanka win the match and the series.
Cricket gave the small island something to celebrate when everything else seemed bleak. Just like it has over the decades, through war and natural disasters. In 1996, at the height of the civil war, Sri Lanka hosted and won the Cricket World Cup.
In 2007, you know, when the last phase of the war was in full flow, there was a game between Sri Lanka and New Zealand. It was the World Cup semi-final. There was kind of an unofficial truce or a ceasefire for that period so that everybody could watch the match.
In Sri Lanka, which has a lot of religious and ethnic divisions, cricket unites. It is much more than a game, says Arunthawanthan. At age 3 or 4, Sri Lankan kids often get their first bat and ball, he says.
Because it's a gateway for people to change their lives. If you see the Sri Lankan team at present, many of them have started from humble beginnings. So it instills belief, inspiration and hope.
In 2004, when a massive tsunami in the Indian Ocean killed thousands of people in Sri Lanka, cricketers, including Australian players, were at the forefront of relief efforts. This time too, Australian cricketers appealed for help for Sri Lanka.
We are in Sri Lanka raising awareness of the economic crisis
and encouraging friends to assist in any ways they can.
The Australia tournament came to an end a few days ago, but a new series has already begun with Pakistan. Whatever happens in the current crisis, Indusan Shantakumaran, the blogger, says Sri Lankans are thankful that at least the cricket will go on. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Hyderabad, India.
There's been a big shakeup in Ukraine's government. President Volodymyr Zelensky made the announcement over the weekend. He said he'd suspended his spy chief, a childhood friend, Ivan Bakanov, and also his prosecutor general, Irina Venediktova, who advised him during his presidential run. The reason? Concerns of treason. The officials themselves are not being accused of collaborating with Russia, but Ukrainians who work under them are. To learn more, we reached out to Volodymyr Solohub, a journalist currently in Western Ukraine. So, Volodymyr, investigators in Ukraine are looking into 651 cases of treason and Russian collaboration. Again, the government spy chief and prosecutor general suspended because it all happened on their watch. Still, that is a lot of alleged turncoats. How surprising is this?
Marco, the announcement was a big shocker to many. Not so much on Ivan Bakanov, though. Rumors about his possible firing were circling around for the past few weeks. With Prosecutor General Venediktova, it was much more surprising because since early days of the war, she started investigating Russian war crimes and prosecuting even perpetrators.
And from your perspective, Volodymyr, do most Ukrainians think their government is riddled with collaborators?
Well, Marco, for the most part, Ukrainians and Ukrainian government are very much united in its fight against the Russian aggression. However, there are cases where law enforcement officials that happened to be in the areas that are occupied now by Russians, they chose to collaborate with Russians. They chose to start working with them. And it's not only about the law enforcement agents. There's even an MP from the president's party in the city of Kherson. He started collaborating with Russians when Kherson was taken over.
Now, President Zelensky's office first said it had sacked these two top officials, fired them. Then the president's people walked that back, right?
Yes, Marco, absolutely. Today in the morning, people clarified that these two top officials were not fired. They were suspended pending the investigation into these possible collaborators within their agencies.
So let's talk about these two people. And since we're already on Venediktova, she is the first woman ever to be in charge of the prosecutor's office and has gotten praise for the work she's done tracking down war criminals. What has been her reputation overall?
There are at least two ongoing court cases right now happening in Ukraine where Russian soldiers are being tried for the war crimes they committed here in Ukraine. There are almost 20,000 criminal cases opened and investigated by her office, and she has also managed to rally an enormous amount of international support and international assistance to Ukrainian government, to Ukrainian prosecutors in prosecuting and investigating these crimes, Marco.
Yeah. And then Ivan Bakanov, I mean, the head of the Ukrainian security service. I know he's been quite close to President Zelensky for many years. Who is he and how did his childhood friendship endure while he became a spy and his friend became a comedian and then the president?
Yes, Marco. When Volodymyr Zelensky became the president, he appointed him as chief of his security service, which is pretty similar to what the FBI does in the United States. But apparently in the last several months, there has been some sort of power struggle within the president's inner circle with president's chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, trying to take more and more control over what the president does and who the president talks to. And apparently, this is the result of this internal power struggle over access to the president that is now pushing out Bakanov to the sidelines.
Journalist Volodymyr Solohub speaking with us from Western Ukraine about a shakeup in the Ukrainian government. Volodymyr, thank you as always.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Israel is creating more places where the sexes are separated. It's seen as a way to open up space for ultra-Orthodox Jews, but some say this is not simply about separating men and women.
It's not about sex segregation. It's about sex discrimination, removing women completely, excluding them out of sight.
And we look at the rise of evangelical political power in Brazil coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Turn on the news these days, and it seems like protests and street demonstrations are erupting pretty much everywhere across the globe, and more often. There is a way to measure this. The Mass Mobilization Project has been doing exactly that. David Clark built the protest database. He's a political scientist at Binghamton University in New York. So what does your data tell us over the past decade or so, David? Are protests increasing?
Over the past decade, I would say that there has been an increase in protest activity, though there was a steep decline with the onset of COVID, at least of traditional protest behavior, people in the streets. There was actually a move to alternative types of protests for a brief period in 2020, people banging pots and pans from balconies and windows and driving around in car convoys, things like that. But since the onset of the pandemic, normal levels of protests, what really preceded the pandemic, have returned globally.
you approach this from a scientific point of view, building this database. When you're measuring this, what counts as a protest?
Well, in our data, we try to limit this to protests that are 50 people or more, simply as an effort to try not to capture, you know, where you have three people out on the street.
We're seeing a lot of headlines about protests. What does that tell us? Does it just appear that there's a lot?
I think we're seeing more headlines having to do with what the protests are over. There's been a huge increase since about 2015 in protests demanding the removal of governments. And in fact, this is exactly the central demand that we're seeing in Sri Lanka. Those protests actually have been going on since the early to mid-spring, but they really have gained traction as they've had some success in actually getting government officials to step down. I think those are the kinds of issues that tend to catch the media's attention and make front page news more often.
So many kind of specific causes for protests, over lack of democracy. If you go back to the start of the Syrian civil war, police violence, military rule, government mismanagement in Sri Lanka, as you just cited. In China recently, a rare moment of protests at a bank where depositors were furious they couldn't get their money. What cause of protest movements do you think we should be paying the most attention to?
I think some of the things that put people in the street with the most uncertain outcomes are surprises. So not being able to get your money out of a bank is a big surprise. We've seen this around other issues that are both crucial to people's individual day-to-day lives and come as surprises, as shocks to them. The Sudanese protests in late 2018 were initially spurred by the removal of food subsidies. So the prices of food and fuel skyrocketed overnight. That put people in the streets. Both it was a surprise and it's something that hit very, very close to home for a lot of folks. What made those protests escalate, and I think we've seen this exact dynamic in Sri Lanka, is that the government was very heavy-handed in putting down those protests. In Sudan, that served to nationalize the protests and create organization around a protest movement. So the combination of forces, like economic forces that are important to day-to-day subsistence for citizens, combined with these shocks, these surprises that affect their day-to-day survival, I think are likely to put people in the streets and probably put them in the streets in large numbers.
So what would you say is driving these protests? I mean, generically, we can say economic hardship and political dissatisfaction, but drill deeper.
There's been a personalization of politics in a lot of countries around the globe in the last 10 to 15 years as populist tendencies have proliferated. More and more leaders are running on populist principles where they blame the system, where they blame incumbents, and where they personalize politics. I think these things tend to rile people up in ways that get them in the streets, making specific demands for government change. So I think that that's a trend we've seen in the last decade, and I think that the populist movement has played a major role in that.
So as I think about the bank protest in China, I mean, there's not much protest in China. I wonder if you see any influence of one country's protests over another. Does your data suggest that protest movement in one place can spark protests in another country?
I think that more what's going on now is there's a convergence of cause, a convergence of problems across the globe. You know, most countries are dealing with some kind of economic trouble at this point. Inflation is fairly widespread. And so this common set of problems is probably driving a lot of these protests. So they look similar, but they're probably just coming from the same kinds of sources rather than spilling across borders, so to speak.
David Clark is a professor of political science at Binghamton University in New York. He's built a data set called the Mass Mobilization Project that tracks protests around the globe. David, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Picture a national legislature where a lawmaker refuses to take his seat. Why? Well, because a female lawmaker is seated next to him, and his religious beliefs dictate that men and women need to be separated. This happened in Israel's Knesset last year. The lawmaker was from one of the Jewish ultra-Orthodox political parties, and his request was granted. This sort of thing does not go over well with many Israelis, but gender segregation has been happening more and more, and debate around it is large, as Yoshi Fields reports from Tel Aviv.
On one level, this debate is about religion and about how Jews in Israel interpret religious guidelines. But for a lot of people, that's not really what's at stake here.
If you connect the dots, like I do in my research, you see that it's not about sex segregation. It's about sex discrimination.
That's Yofi Tirosh, a law professor at Tel Aviv University. For all the complexity around this topic, Tirosh believes that at its core, the real reason for the spread of segregation is not about religious law, but about
removing women completely, excluding them out of sight.
I could see why people would think that. I never experienced it that way.
On the other side, there's people like Pearlie Zucker, who says she's most comfortable with that separation. She's an ultra-Orthodox woman living in Jerusalem.
I really do think that these requests are misinterpreted. You don't really see why it's taken as an assault against women.
These requests are misinterpreted, she says. They're really a protection for the sacredness of marriage. One of the most contentious battlegrounds is with college courses. About 12% of the population of Israel is ultra-Orthodox. They're called Haredi. And they are severely underrepresented in higher education. That's partly because they largely refuse co-ed classes. To make higher education more accessible, over the past decade, more than a dozen colleges and universities have opened gender-segregated classes. Leah Aroni is a businesswoman in Jerusalem. She says Israel should make accommodations for those from the ultra-Orthodox community.
I think that each community should be respected to have its own cultural norms. And I think in Israel, the Haredi community should be given the same kind of credit. It's kind of paternalistic and condescending for one community to tell other communities what to do.
Men and women are growing up in these communities that seeing the other gender is always through the lens of sexuality.
Nechuma Yaffe is one of the ultra-Orthodox students who studied in an all-girls program in college.
It is threatening to just being adult and all of a sudden sitting next to a woman or for a woman sitting next to a man.
Never, she says, would she have been able to attend college if there wasn't an option for segregated classes.
Which is so far removed from my perception.
Since then, however, she's continued her studies, eventually getting a postdoc at Princeton and now teaches at Tel Aviv University. But Yofi Tirosh, the law professor, argues that Yaffe is more an exception than the norm. While there has been an increase in religious students entering college, she says that the class offerings are not equal.
What we see is that it actually translates into asymmetrical conditions to women.
College courses geared towards women, she says, are often in education or nursing, but men have a wider range of classes that lead to higher paying careers.
As women have been used to throughout history, we are being told, wait with your equality. There are more pressing issues on the table. So we'll get to you. But right now, we need to integrate other people into society.
Last year, after a 7-year-long battle, the Supreme Court of Israel ruled that segregated classes are allowed. Tirosh, the primary petitioner to the High Court in the case, is worried that this opens the door to even more sex segregation throughout Israeli society.
10 years ago, when I said, look, it's going to expand beyond what you promise, I had a hard time because people said this is a slippery slope argument.
Today, there are separate sections for men and women at concerts, separate workspaces, women barred from speaking at certain public events, and there are more incidents of women being asked to leave a public space or simply not be allowed in. Bus drivers refuse entry because they say a female passenger is dressed immodestly. A children's religious basketball team refuses to play because one of the opposing players is a girl. The ultra-Orthodox lawmaker refusing to sit next to a woman, even though ultra-Orthodox and female lawmakers have been sitting together since the beginning of the country.
What kind of a society would we look like once we finished integrating them by moving women out of sight?
It hasn't always been like this, even in the ultra-Orthodox community. Esti Rieder-Endorski defines herself as a feminist and ultra-Orthodox. She says that over the past decade, the rules around men and women in her community have become increasingly harsh.
Something happened, like, you know, the ultra-Orthodoxy was hijacked.
You don't see signs with pictures of women. You don't see that anymore. And you don't see women anywhere.
Images of women are rarely seen in advertisements and in religious newspapers. Pictures of women are sometimes blurred or erased. And the lengths to which men and women are separated have become more extreme. Rita Andorsky says she can no longer even enter most synagogues through the same entrance as the men. Instead, she goes through a back entrance, often next to the garbage.
These are all new inventions of the last few years of people that are trying to fight women from their power and trying to put them in the place.
Again, Rita Andorsky is a devout person. She wears a wig and she says she sits in the women's side of the synagogue. But she also believes that women need to be empowered. They need to have a voice across society. For example, she points out, all of the lawmakers with the ultra-Orthodox political parties are men.
Because women are not sitting in the decision-making circle. They're not sitting around the table at all. They cannot influence, and things are getting more and more severe.
And that trend will be harder to stop, she says, if secular Israelis go along with more sex segregation. That would simply give the men in charge of the ultra-Orthodox community more leeway to impose even harsher rules to keep the sexes apart. For The World, I'm Yoshi Fields in Tel Aviv.
Goo goo gaga. Yep, baby talk for some people. Those made-up words that adults use, which make no sense to us or babies, they actually transcend borders. According to a study published today, baby talk across 21 societies and 6 continents is basically the same. Samuel Mayer is one of the study's authors. He's a senior scientist at the Language Research Center Haskins Laboratories at Yale University. So, Samuel, we know a lot of English-speaking adults often automatically start to talk to infants in baby talk. How did you discover that baby talk is similar across languages?
We've known for a while that in at least a few languages, when people speak to infants, they alter the sounds of their voice. And anybody who's ever picked up an infant and happens to live in a place that speaks one of these languages has experienced this for themselves. What's new here is that this topic has not been studied across many, many different societies in a standardized fashion. So that's what we've done. We have a big team of anthropologists and psychologists who've collected infant-directed speech and infant-directed song from many different places around the world in many different languages. And we've analyzed that in this paper.
Speech and song. I know our listeners are going to want to hear this. So we're going to hear some examples and then get you to explain. The first is what you call infant-directed speech. This is in Mandarin.
Mama, honey, shi jiao jiao. Oh, oh. Guai, guai, shi jiao jiao.
All right, so that's infant-directed as opposed to what we're going to hear now, adult-directed Mandarin.
You can... 从这儿坐370到玉泉路,从玉泉路直接坐地铁,然后呢?
Okay, so that's adult-directed speech to contrast what we just heard a moment ago, infant-directed. We're going to hear another pair in English. Again, infant-directed speech first.
Jocelyn, it's a darling. Jocelyn, oh my baby.
All right, this is English from New Zealand, and here is the adult directed in English.
So later on today, we are heading to town to sign our wills, which is the first will I've ever made. Then we're having lunch with Dad in town somewhere.
Samuel, unpack what we were just hearing there.
So when they're speaking to the infant, the fundamental frequency of their speech, the pitch, is a bit higher, and it's also a bit more variable. It moves around in their vocal range quite a bit more when they're speaking to an infant as opposed to speaking to an adult. And what we were able to show in this study is that across a wide range of acoustic features, things like the vowel space that's used, the roughness of the vocalization, the clarity of any pulse that's there, seems to consistently be altered for infants across the different languages that we've been studying here.
So you also said that you had studied singing, and we're going to hear now two examples of infant-directed singing and adult-directed singing. This is from the United States, the infant-directed singing first.
Five little ducks went swimming one day over the hill and far away. Mother duck said, quack, 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 but only four little ducks came back.
All right, infant-directed, and now the adult-directed singing.
I set out on a narrow way many years ago, hoping I would find true love along the broken road.
So what changes with the child? What is the child hearing between infant-directed singing and adult-directed singing?
What we found here is that in language, the acoustics that make something infant-directed are different than the acoustics that make music infant-directed. So the difference between those two singing examples acoustically was not the same difference as the difference between the infant-directed speech and adult-directed speech. So rather than it being in a much higher pitch and a much more variable pitch, the infant-directed singing was lower intensity than the adult-directed singing. It had a higher variability in its vowel space than the adult-directed singing. So it's basically a different set of acoustic features that characterize infant-directed music.
Really fascinating stuff. So what is the takeaway, Samuel? What does this say about adult brains and how they are basically wired across different languages around the world to do basically the same spoken activity?
One of the ways that human minds work often is in the care of infants. Human infants are altricial relative to other species. Infants need a lot of care in our species. And so in that light, it's not actually that surprising that we would have special vocalizations for infants, and infants should have special preparation in their auditory perceptual abilities to hear these different vocalizations and understand them. What's especially new here, though, is that the way those bits of our psychology work seem to really differ across language and music.
Finally, does your study kind of tangentially help us understand human speech better and how it evolved?
The way these infant-directed speech vocalizations are shaped could very well be tuned toward the specific features of the language that the infant is trying to learn in the culture where that speech is produced. When there's that variability in each of these societies, for example, you know, if there's some society that the language they speak has, you know, acoustic feature A as opposed to acoustic feature B, to, you know, that's important for them understanding language, despite that specific development that might happen in that society, across all the societies that we're studying, there are some general features that are held in common.
Samuel Mayer is a senior scientist at the Language Research Center Haskins Laboratories at Yale University. He's one of the authors of a study looking at how baby talk is similar across many languages and countries around the globe. Samuel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Brazil is considered the largest Catholic country in the world, but growing quickly in Brazil is the number of Protestant evangelicals. They make up roughly a third of Brazil's religious population today, and they're expected to become the majority in less than a generation. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has helped boost their political influence, and he's hoping to benefit from their support again when he runs for re-election later this year. Today, we have the first in a week-long series about the political rise of evangelicals in Brazil. Reporter Michael Fox begins our coverage.
In the run-up to the 2018 election in Brazil, it wasn't clear that far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro could actually win. But one group of voters was all in. In September of that year, I was interviewing evangelical Christians outside of a church in Rio de Janeiro when I was approached by a group of teenagers. They were members of a youth group from a neighboring Pentecostal church, and they were canvassing for their candidates, including Bolsonaro. They told me if I really wanted to talk to evangelicals, like active and politicized evangelicals, I needed to visit their church. So I did. The Assembly of God Victory in Christ Church is in a working-class neighborhood of Rio de Janeiro. It's a huge block-long megachurch with stadium-style seating, a rocking six-piece band, and an impressive light show. It's an example of the growing evangelical population in Brazil and a sign of their increasing power. Even 4 years ago, pastors here were not shy about setting their sights high.
Daqui a 5 to 10 years, a gente quer atingir os sete montes. A gente chama de sete montes da sociedade.
Within 5 to 10 years, we want to have a profound influence on all sectors of Brazilian society, said Samuel Amorim, a youth pastor at the church. We want to be involved in the economy, politics, sports, science, and culture. Then, like today, Bolsonaro was their man. In fact, the church's founder, firebrand televangelist Silas Malafaia, actually married Bolsonaro and his current wife, Michele, in 2013.
Esse camarada... Ele é a favor dos valores de família.
Malafaia is one of the most outspoken Pentecostal pastors in the country. He has 1.5 million subscribers on YouTube. He's also one of Bolsonaro's more ardent supporters. That's him backing Bolsonaro for the presidency in 2018. Evangelicals voted en masse for Bolsonaro, lifting him to power with his slogan, Brazil above everyone, God above all. Diego Valentim da Silva is another pastor at Silas Malafaia's church. He told me, Bolsonaro's against abortion. He defends family values. So we see in him someone who's embracing our cause. Bolsonaro has made good on his promise to fight for those values.
Não vem papai e mamãe jogar no colo do Ministério da Saúde.
He's allocated state funds for evangelical TV stations and appointed evangelical pastors into key positions in his government. That's Minister of Human Rights and Family Damares Alves talking about how TikTok is in part to blame for underage pregnancies. Bolsonaro has opened his doors to top church leaders, marched with Christians in Brasilia, and late last year appointed André Mendonça as the country's first evangelical Supreme Court minister. In a video that went viral, Bolsonaro's wife Michele, a devout evangelical herself, celebrated the approval of Mendonça's appointment by crying and speaking in tongues. There's probably no other group that Bolsonaro has more vocally courted, and no other voting bloc that's been as loyal to this president.
Acho que os evangélicos nunca tiveram tanto espaço dentro.
Political scientist Victor Araújo says evangelicals have never had so much space in a presidency. This explains why Bolsonaro still has so much support from these voters, he says. In recent polls, Bolsonaro trails former leftist president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Lula's message about helping the poor resonates with some evangelicals. But still, about half of evangelical voters say they want to see Bolsonaro get reelected. And he's not forgetting about them. It's really good to be among those who have God in their hearts, the president told crowds in mid-May. He was at the March for Jesus in the city of Curitiba, the largest annual evangelical mobilization in the country.
Temos hoje presidente, governo que acredita em Deus.
Today, you have a president and a government that believes in God, he said, and defends Brazilian families. Bolsonaro's religious messaging is unprecedented for a Brazilian head of state. Previous presidents, including Lula, developed solid relationships with church leaders, but Bolsonaro has lifted evangelical language and policy priorities to the fore. University of Sao Paulo political scientist Vinicius Dovale says this is because Bolsonaro knows it's how he can mobilize supporters and win people's hearts, even during tough economic times in Brazil. He doesn't want to discuss inflation, says Dovale. He wants to talk about homosexuality. He wants to discuss abortion. He wants to talk about God.
Nisso aí foi dos fatores cruciais do ter votado nele. Por quê?
That's a major reason why I voted for him, says Cleidimar Lima, a preschool teacher and longtime evangelical who lives in Manaus. Because he recognizes that God is above everything. He defends the family, and today the family is being destroyed. I know he's lost some support, she says, but I'm going to vote for him again. Evangelicals are a diverse group in Brazil. The term actually refers to any non-Catholic Christian, so it includes Baptists and Methodists, as well as Pentecostals, who make up roughly two-thirds of evangelical Christians in Brazil. The Pentecostals tend to be the most ardent Bolsonaro supporters. They're also the most vocal, powerful, and conservative evangelicals in the country. They set the agenda, and they control the evangelical caucus in Congress, with more than 180 members in the lower house. Experts say evangelicals in Brazil are a rising political force, regardless if Bolsonaro is reelected or not. For many of them, being politically active is a duty. We have to make our citizenship count, Pastor Silas Malafaia told me down one of the back hallways of his church. We have a right to put our opinions out there and to vote for the people who support us. And churches like his are growing too, particularly in Brazil's poorest communities. When I met Jesus, it was totally different. It was like being born again, says Aurea Cristina, a soft-spoken manicurist sitting in one of the back pews in Malafaia's church. It changed my life, she says. And it's stories like hers that are changing Brazil. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
This story is part of our Sacred Nation series, all about the intersection of religion and nationalism around the globe. It's funded by the Henry Luce Foundation. Check out Sacred Nation online at theworld.org/sacrednation. Tomorrow we'll hear about one of Brazil's rising political stars who's promoting some policies that evangelicals really like. That's tomorrow. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we will see you right back here tomorrow. From PRX.